Source for Open Law, and specifically the Open Law Project of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. So Open Law, which you can find online at openlaw.org, is an experiment in applying methods of open source development to legal argument and to bringing public discussion to the process of developing legal arguments. I think law is partly open source, at least. Its source code is freely available, minus some details of interest to the lawyers. Only you can get the law, and it's not copyrighted or copyrightable as a product of the government. You can find lots of pieces of it online at the Cornell servers and Library of Congress. It's modifiable, either indirectly by good lawyering or directly by good lobbying and lots of money. Good decisions describe their revision history. So you look at one like ACLU versus Reno, where the court describes the case history that came before it and how its decision fits into the legal precedents. And it can fork and resolve forks because the Supreme Court, interpreting the supreme law of the land, will resolve splits among the circuits, and deep splits over constitutional issues, at least, get resolved at the Supreme Court. And it's fitting that the law is open source because due process requires that we be able to know the law that we're expected to follow. The law should be accessible to all if we're expected to be bound by it. But the process of lawmaking has been less open. So big money often dominates the legislation and litigation. And much of the argument is developed in law firms, lobbying houses, and places that aren't accessible to the public. We don't have a lot of law developing from public referendums and public input. And unfortunately, the results aren't often so accessible to the public either. They're written in specialized language and involve complex procedures. And because of the common law process, a lot of the interpretation is only found in a long history of case law. It's not sometimes clear from the face of a statute what the legal interpretation is going to be. And so Open Law is a Berkman Center project, an umbrella for a set of projects to make the law more accessible to the public and to get the public involved in the legal discussion on these issues that deeply affect them. So we've tried to create open fora for discussions online, and we've taken a few cases through this method. The Eldred versus Ashcroft challenge to the copyright term extension was the first case, and we've also gotten involved in the DVD DCSS case of Universal versus Ramirez. And we also put the Chilling Effects project, which helps to people to understand and respond to cease and desist letters threatening their online activity under the Open Law umbrella. So, Open Law first developed in the initial stages of the Eldred versus Ashcroft, when it was still Eldred versus Reno, challenge to the copyright term extension. Congress had passed the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act that added 20 years to the terms of all existing and future copyrights. And on behalf of Eric Eldred, a publisher of public domain literature online, and a series of other groups and individuals who wanted to use works from the public domain, we wanted to challenge this law because the Constitution says that Congress has the power to grant protection for limited times to authors and inventors, and it seemed to us that going back and extending existing copyrights violated that limited times principle. But it was also important because this is the Berkman Center, and because the Berkman Center has a general commitment to openness in code, in education, and in law, we wanted to bring the public further into the process. The public domain exists for the public to draw upon and reuse, and we wanted the public to be involved in that discussion and development of argument. In an ordinary litigation, although this was a public interest case, the discussion would all happen in the law firms with a little bit of back and forth with the named plaintiffs in the suit. Maybe we would reach out at some point down the road to find some groups interested in filing amicus briefs, friend of the court briefs, but most of the discussion would happen in a fairly closed format. And, well, the secrecy might be good for ambush. In a case like this, there really wasn't much that was going to be pulled out as a smoking gun, nothing that the secrecy would really advance the cause. And instead, we decided that perhaps by reaching out to the public, we would get additions to the debate, additions to put into the briefs, additional evidence on the value of the public domain, and more importantly, we would be able to involve the public in the process to understand how the litigation is done, to understand what the issues are, to understand the importance of the fight for the public domain, and to build some of the kinds of grassroots efforts that might stop Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act number 2 from passing next time it came through Congress when Mickey Mouse was once again about to expire. So we wanted to enable the public to join these discussions and after the Eldred case, we also opened up a forum for the DCSS cases discussing challenges to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act anti-circumvention provisions. And so we started out, we put up a website, we described what was going on in the case, and we gave an email address. Well, that's great for putting up information, but not so great for building an interactive process. And so over time, we began developing a whole toolkit of these small pieces loosely joined, the kind of development that often goes on in open source, of pulling things together that already existed. We weren't looking to reinvent some of the technical framework, but looking to pull pieces that already existed into this new environment. So we have the Open Law website. And the Open Law website invites people to visit the cases that we're reviewing and invites them to subscribe to a general purpose mailing list for broadcast announcements of what's happening in various cases. And then it gives brief introductions to the cases for the first-time visitor. So somebody coming in to look at Eldred versus Ashcroft sees a website that's done in basically a blog style with recent updates up at the top and information about how to participate. The same thing happens for the Open DVD discussion. We give an introduction to the issues, why people should be concerned that the law now makes it unlawful to circumvent technological protections around copyrighted works, which boils down to if the copyright holder has chosen to lock up something released, say, on DVD, then You're not free to develop a program that will read it and remix it or do something more interesting than simply pop it into a DVD player and watch it from the beginning. And we go through inviting people to join the mailing lists. The website is searchable. You can search it either through our internal search engine or, of course, through Google. We've developed frequently asked questions, the kinds of things that come up on mailing lists, and as they repeat themselves, we add them into the facts so that people can be introduced to the players, the technologies at issue, and then onto the legal issues, so that because these are complex issues, we find we begin with sort of just, oh, what's going on here? What does it mean that this case has been brought? And once people have gotten through that stage, then they get into, okay, so what can we do in particular to help out? And then down into the level of detail of, all right, what does this statutory language mean and what kinds of challenges can we raise? So the website contains relatively static content. Try to keep simple introductions to the project, try to keep those things updated so that people can visit quickly and figure out what's going on in the cases. A lot of the activity takes place on mailing lists, and as anyone who has participated in mailing lists knows, those can get to be very high volume. They have the advantage of being rapid feedback, so somebody puts something in and with hundreds of participants is likely to get some kind of response to the message. He doesn't just think his message is going into the air, but it can be a challenge not to lose good ideas from that mix as threads trail off and people move off in different directions, going back through even with searchable archives online and even with new additions like RSS feeds to enable people to follow the lists in different ways. It can be a challenge to orchestrate large-scale drafts through an online mailing list. So we've moved some of that work onto wikis, the editable web page. Anybody can go in and make a revision to the online texts and gives us basically a single source tree that people are working, putting all of their efforts into one place. So something like this was when the parties after the hearing in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals on the DCSS case, when the court had said it was very interested in the arguments and still had a few questions for the parties. Open law participants took those questions and began to develop answers that we could then offer to the lawyers as parts of the discussion here. And so the wiki allows us to go in and add questions and add snippets or full-formed arguments to the discussion that we can then compile into the elements of a brief. We also developed this little annotation engine that allows people to add notes to a pre-existing text elsewhere. And for example, this was answering questions. The Motion Picture Association had developed a frequently asked questions file from their point of view on how DVDs worked and how the DVD copy controls were important to their business. And we went in and annotated that frequently asked questions file from our own server with responses and opposition viewpoints. We used bulletin boards as well, but often found that because those were less interactive than the wiki or mailing list, that those fell out of use. Somebody would post something and without any immediate notification of feedback would become less interested in the subject and move on to something else, whereas the wiki would give much more direct comment, and the mailing list, of course, would give often immediate feedback, if only of knowing that your message had gone into the mailboxes of hundreds of other participants, whether or not they all read it. So open law products, in the loose sense, we've involved a group of more than 500 people in legal discussion. Just introducing them to the questions gotten a lot of technologists interested in the legal discussions here and concerned about the legal environment, particularly the environment created by the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and helped to stir up public debate on the subject. A lot of people have taken some of these ideas into activist groups and groups that are working to fight against in many of the state-level DMCA laws that the Motion Picture Association is currently trying to have passed. In the Eldred case, we collected a series of examples of uses of the public domain. People pulled up articles from news reports and research analyses of the kinds of works that would have been prevented had a copyright term extension been in place when they were created, the kinds of reworkings of public domain works ranging from Bernstein's reuse of Shakespeare in West Side Story to performances that the James Joyce estate had tried to suppress using copyright, basically explaining how the public domain figures into culture and helping us to put these things into a record that would help a court to understand this is not just about granting 20 more years of income to Disney, but also about making the public wait 20 more years for the right to create innovative performances and multimedia projects and other creative derivative works of older works in copyright. We had a lot of people who were able to do technical analyses of DVDs and DCSS to help explain to the lawyers in the case just what is being prevented and what is being locked up with the CSS copy protection. A lot of the language in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act speaks about technical measures that effectively prevent access to a copyrighted work and how how the access must be granted with authority of the copyright holder. And we had a series of analyses of how precisely the DVD player unlocks the CSS mechanism on the DVD and plays the disc. And it turns out that, I mean, if you get your authorization through the DVD player and the disc from the motion picture industry, it wasn't entirely clear, and it still is not entirely clear, that this is a technological protection in the sense of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. But that argument is ongoing now in the Northern District of California, where 321 Studios is arguing for the right to make software that makes backup copies of DVDs. And once again, the movie studios have come in claiming that this is a circumvention device under the DMCA. OpenLaw also came together to produce some amicus briefs in the DCSS case. In the district court, when the court was considering whether to enjoin 2600 Magazine from publishing or hyperlinking to DCSS, saying that even by hyperlinking, 2600 was providing the circumvention device, OpenLaw put together a brief on specifically on hyperlinking as speech, noting that this was a group that had come together through hyperlinks and the web, and our entire association was founded on the web and its ability to bring people together through hyperlinks. We tried to argue that the link itself is merely a location pointer and not the code itself, should be treated as speech. Unfortunately, that argument had as much success as any of the other arguments that we made in defending that suit, which is not very much, but it was nonetheless a good experience to have put together this brief, which we then submitted on behalf of the diverse participants in the Open Law group as a friend of the court brief, trying to explain the issues from a different perspective. Yes, they did. Did the court accept the amicus brief? And the answer is yes, they did. We had to put in both the brief itself and a motion and memorandum explaining our interest in filing the brief. And they accepted it, but didn't necessarily do very much with it. So we also, a lot of the ideas that were developed through the Open Law Forum then went into a long series of amicus briefs that went into the appeals and the Second Circuit. There were briefs from cryptographers and computer scientists and users of the public domain and publishers. So some of those were taking ideas that had been developed through the open law process and available in the archives here. We put in comments in the Copyright Office rulemakings, trying to explain when they held rulemakings on the anti-circumvention proceedings why controls that function not only to control access to copyrighted works, but also use of those works, shouldn't fit within the protection of the DMCA. We also have just sets of archives of all of the material that's been generated in any of these cases. So you can find all of the briefs put in by supporters of 2600, the briefs put in by the opponents, including MPAA and all of their friends, and the various opinions rendered in the case. Also links to articles and other resources. And then overall, we've generated the toolkit that we can now place another case into for a similar discussion. In a little bit of a SourceForge manner, we, when we find interesting cases, can put them into this framework and give people access to the set of tools that we've developed. So I'm going to take a little bit of a divergence or a little bit of a fork to talk about the Chilling Effects Project, which in the same broad sense of bringing the law to the public and helping people to understand their rights aims to bring some transparency into the legal process. Chilling Effects responds to one of the dual nature of the internet. It lets more people publish more easily and more cheaply than they could before, but it also lets more people monitor that speech and find things that they dislike. If you're handing out a pamphlet, it's unlikely that a trademark holder is going to come find you and complain that his trademark was reproduced in your pamphlet. If you're publishing it online, they can send out a little search bot that simply searches for every occurrence of their trademarked term and notifies them that it's time to send out another slew of cease and desist letters. So it's pretty easy for a big company to send out a cease and desist letter. They've often got form letters and in-house counsel or outside firms who are able to send out letters pretty quickly. And the letters often get these websites shut down because simply through the threat without any follow-on. So here's a cease and desist letter that's not very readable, but the highlighted portion is describing all of the possible consequences. This infringement carries the strong possibility of very substantial statutory damages, the imposition of a federal injunction and award of attorney's fees. Basically, somebody receiving this letter is quite likely simply to pull down the website or the program he was offering and move on. So Chilling Effects is a reference to this deterrent effect of the simple threat, the shadow of the law, even when there's no legal proof that someone was engaging in unlawful conduct. Simply, he doesn't have the money to, or the resources to fight it, and will often just pull down the site. So Chilling Effects offers a place where people can come and read about the law in a series of subjects. Again, right now this is mostly United States law, but we're hoping through partnerships with institutions abroad to expand to discussion of other countries' law as well. It's a collaboration among the Electronic Frontier Foundation and law school clinics at Harvard, Stanford, Berkeley, University of San Francisco, and University of Maine right now. And people can read information in various topic areas. They can read recently submitted cease and desist letters. Here we've got one from the RIAA to an FTP host complaining that somebody has approximately zero copyrighted files being offered from his website. And this was when the Motion Picture Association had to retract a string of letters because apparently a temp wasn't doing a very good job of reviewing the letters. You wonder if this is just the ones they were caught with or or more. But yes, you're offering approximately zero song files for download. And what all of this highlighting is law students annotating the letter to explain the legal terms and explain what's happening in this letter. So we've received a complaint about copyright infringement, goes into some of the notification and takedown provisions of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Let's see what's linked on Zero Sound Files. Is all copying piracy? This question is going into a discussion of fair use, and also worth noting, of course, that if there's nothing copied, there can be no copyright infringement. Does the copyright owner have to specify the exact materials? It's unlikely that this copyright owner specified any materials at all. So chilling effect is giving people information. And finally, it's asking people who receive cease and desist letters to report those to us and add them to the database and then to let us annotate them and publish them for other people to learn from. We've got, is it just for copyright? No, we have copyright, trademark, patent, and some of the other assorted claims like misappropriation that people sometimes bring, or the claim that unauthorized linking is a violation of something or other. Here's a brief list. We have some information for even for people who have posted anonymously and are concerned that somebody is requesting their identity, an area that we're afraid will grow if the RIAA is successful in its lawsuit against Verizon to ask Verizon to disclose the names of subscribers who were claimed to be hosting copyrighted files on peer-to-peer services. So Chilling Effects tries to, first off, to inform internet users of their rights and to let people resist claims that are clearly without merit. And then to highlight the problems with existing law, if these claims have the effect of getting people to stop what they're doing, even if there's no merit to them, or if claims that seem absolutely silly can still result in online takedowns, simply publicizing that and giving people information about it is a first step toward getting some of those laws changed. And that feeds into gathering data about the problems of CHIL. We were able to use some of these letters, particularly some of the misfired DMCA demands, in a brief supporting Verizon in that litigation over whether it should reveal subscribers' names. In that cost-benefit equation of should I just send out a cease and desist letter, we hope to increase the cost a little bit by putting these silly cease and desist letters out there and letting people laugh at the trademark owner like Godzilla, who tries to go after the little website Davezilla and claims that that's causing confusion and people might think it's sponsored by Toho. And finally, because we're working with a series of law school clinics, we hope to give law students experience that will help them to go out into the world as lawyers on the right side of these issues who are able to go out and help people in this kind of situation, or who are able to, when counseling companies, advise them to think twice before sending a meritless cease and desist letter. So a few more screenshots on chilling effects and some URLs. And I'm happy to take questions.
Wendy, how is the work that you guys are doing funded right now?
Basically, it's work that's supported by Berkman Center and by EFF, and most of it is not separately funded at this point.
So the broader question is, this is very interesting work, it's exciting to see. What do you think in an open society is the right way to fund this kind of work? You know, should the EFF turn into the ACLU and just and raise money and just do this sort of thing?
Well, so I guess if it would be nice to have enough money to be able to take all of these things on as cases. At the moment, the Chilling Effects Project, for example, is limited to giving information and not legal advice because we simply don't have the resources to track down all of the facts about all of these cases and give true legal advice. I guess our ultimate goal is to help change the law so fewer of these cases arise. Since that seems a long way off, I think we do need to think about sources of public funding for efforts like this.
Well, you know, more than, I mean, certainly there is a strong political component to the work being done here, but fundamentally, this is about using the web to communicate about the law in ways that are now possible because of technology that weren't possible before. For American law, giving American citizens access to the process in ways that they didn't before. And it seems to me that that's almost a governmental function, right? Is it a free press? I mean, it's neat to see this. I wonder how in the future this sort of effort is supported and goes forward.
Yeah, that's an interesting suggestion to try to get, perhaps even to get more governments involved in making their processes open and using tools like this for online discussion. We see courts moving toward online filing and online publication. And maybe the next step is to invite them to invite other arms of government to embrace an online discussion like this.
I was wondering if you had any particular information on sort of breaking down the, the level of legal expertise of the different people who participate in the site, whether it was primarily, also an adjunct question of whether you were particularly trying to get the site to be used by people who are, by upcoming lawyers, or if this is, and you have types of evangelization that you might be doing, or if it's sort of these are long-term goals. So I guess particularly, show earlier that you have over 500 non-lawyers who have accounts on the site. Is this something that you are you're working to more towards public participation, or are you thinking, or do you sort of make a difference between student lawyers, academic lawyers, professional, and the public at large?
Well, the participation has mostly been among non-lawyers, in part because it's still difficult to get lawyers out of the mindset of doing everything offline in private. So that input at the beginning shaped the direction of the project to reaching out to non-lawyers and academic lawyers to discussing the issue. And so a lot of the work was making the legal discussion understandable to non-lawyers, but it was fairly quickly brought to the point where they could make meaningful contributions to the legal debate, showing that sort of, even without the 3 years of law school and assorted training, the questions themselves are ones that non-lawyers can usefully participate in. So I guess most of the open law participation has been non-lawyers and perhaps and some students.
I was wondering, how has this been received by the legal community at large? Have you had a lot of feedback? And where do you see things going? I mean, do you have some ideas for augmenting this further? What are some of the directions, maybe research directions, that you're looking at in terms of the future?
So a lot of the feedback from the legal community has been sort of interest, but we'd never try it ourselves. Sort of, great that you're doing it, really neat idea, but we wouldn't put that into one of our cases because a lot of them still think that the secrecy is more important than the kind of reach that we've gotten here. And, I mean, frankly, that's a decision that has to be made on a client-by-client basis. There will be lots of attorney-client confidences that can't be broadcast in an open forum. So this only works with cases that where either it's not necessary to put all of those confidences into the discussion to develop arguments, or where it's a more public-oriented case that there isn't so much secret to begin with. And we're still thinking about where to go next with the project, whether there are other cases that would benefit from this kind of treatment. Certainly, the gathering of resources is useful in a lot of places, and cases that, particularly in cases that repeat themselves, the same kind of scenario will happen over again. The developing resource bank can be applied over again.
I'm sure this is probably covered in the website, but if I receive cease and desist, mechanically, what do I do? Contact. I'm looking at it and I say it's absurd. So, do I contact you guys? But where does it go from there? In other words, I can see that you mark up the letter on a wiki, but do I then send a letter to the attorney at big law firm saying see wiki at mechanically what happens? And if the other thing is, this is interesting. If you Google cease and desist, you don't get anything about chilling effects. Interestingly, though, you do get the Dave Zillow. So it may be a good idea to try to get a free text ad from Google saying,
Last time I checked, we were up there, but maybe we've been bumped down.
Maybe you don't. You're not above the fold.
Okay. So, mechanically, we try to state up front that chilling effects can't be a substitute for legal advice. So, if you were to go through the process of submitting a letter, you would see, this is not legal advice, please contact an attorney, and that we can't, with the students working on the project, we can't even commit that you would receive it in time for a deadline. You might instead browse or search for some of the terms that were in your cease and desist to see similar letters that had already been marked up and figure out from there how likely it was that the claims in your letter were well-founded. And so the markup is aimed more at the layman who might not understand what a claim of copyright infringement means or what the basic outlines of a fair use defense are. If you got the letter because you quoted a paragraph out of somebody else's text, coming to chilling effects might help you to understand that that's most likely a fair use. And from there, you could decide, do you need to hire an attorney? Can you just respond? Can you just ignore the letter? And and basically gives a set of resources that might help you to figure out where to go from there. Oh, we didn't have the microphone. So responding to a letter, do you point to the chilling effect site? You can also just say, based on my understanding of the law, this appears to be a fair use. If it's a case that you can also contact the various clinics who are working on chilling effects and see whether the clinic can provide something that's closer to advice.
Can a clinic actually do pro bono?
Yes, the clinic.
So they in somehow a clinic is actually they have been admitted to the bar.
Well, yeah, there are attorneys practicing at each of the law school clinics who can themselves offer advice or can work with the students in ways that are recognized by various state bars.
Okay, fine. That's exactly.
Okay. I'm pretty much interested about the internationalization of this whole thing, because in the internet, I mean, it's one space, mm-hmm. and normally, if I write something in Switzerland, for example, it's the Swiss law that applies, but I'm not always sure. So you said before that you want to extend this effort to other countries. Where is it, and which are the countries that are the next ones?
Well, if you have contacts who would be interested in joining us, that would... We basically only made initial contacts with some law schools and legal institutions and are still in the very early stages of getting people involved. But the chilling effect side at least works on a modular format that if somebody from Switzerland were interested in joining, they could fairly easily plug into the framework that we have here information about their specific law.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much, Wendy. I hope you'll be back to join us in 20 minutes for a town hall on the whole conference wrap-up.
Thank you.
Thank you all.